This is Alicia Barber. The date is January 27th, 2016, and I'm in Reno, Nevada with Casey and Christian Christensen, owners of the restaurant Soup, which is at 669 South Virginia Street, to conduct an interview for the RTC's Midtown History Project. So, Casey and Christian, do I have your permission to record this interview and make it available to the public?
Yes, you do.
Yes.
Thank you. So we're, of course, focusing on your restaurant in the Midtown District today, but I also want to understand the journey that each of you has taken to reach this point. And I'd like to start out by getting a bit of background information on each of you, and we can go back and forth in this first part. So, Casey, do you want to tell me a little bit about where you're from, where you were born and raised, and where your family's from?
Sure. I was born in Dothan, Alabama, and lived there until I was seven. So born in the South, and ended up moving to Southern California for a little bit, and came out there to visit my grandpa and grandma. My grandpa wasn't doing so good, so we moved out to the West Coast, and huge change coming from Alabama. But we lived there, and I stayed there until I graduated high school when I was 17. I graduated a year early, and I moved to Hawaii. Kind of on a whim, just decided to try something totally different and wanted to get out of Southern California and wanted a different style of life. And so I worked for a nonprofit there for a couple years, and I was on Oahu first, and then I moved to Kauai, and that's where I met Christian. So, and then we have a whole story together after that, but mm-hmm. I worked for the Sheraton, and I taught preschool in the morning, and then was a cocktail waitress at night, and just kind of always been in the service industry for most of my career, has been working in kitchens and working in the front of the house. And so it's been fun though.
Oh, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So your turn. Yeah. Tell me where you're from and where's your family from?
I was born and raised here in Reno, and my grandparents came over from Denmark, with the Garsons and a couple of the Danish families in the area. My grandpa worked for Crescent Creamery for his whole career here, and that was, I don't remember where that was at, somewhere downtown, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom was born up in Idaho, and she moved down here, and my mom and dad have been here ever since. My dad was in the school district for 30-some years, my mom was a dental hygienist for 44 years with the same doctor, and she just retired a couple of years ago. And her dad was actually the food and beverage director at the Nugget with John Esquaga. For his career, started as a dishwasher and worked his way up to the food and beverage director by the time they had the big tower. So I kind of got a good influence of cooking, I think, from him, and then my Danish grandma doing cookies and pastry. So I started, first job was Shakey's Pizza on 5th Street, and worked there for quite a few years. Went to Pneumatic Diner, worked there for a while, Cafe Soleil, a couple others, and had an opportunity to move to Kauai to do an apprenticeship sort of deal at the Hyatt. Ended up just getting there, and they tossed me in the little burger shop down by the pool, and I had to work my way up to have a sous chef opportunity there, and ended up getting a phone call from Tim Helian, seeing if I'd be interested in coming back and trying to help save the Dew. So I drug Casey back here after, you know, we met in Kauai, and drug her back to Reno, and next thing you know, we worked the Dew for a little while, and it had some troubles, and left there, went to Colorado, came back, and we opened our own little private chef business, cooked for two local families for about 4 years in their house.
I was a personal assistant for them, and Christian was their personal chef. So we got to work for two families, and so we've worked together in some form or another since we met in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Was when we met in Hawaii, and then we've worked together since 2001, basically. Started working in some way, like either he was back of the house, I was front of the house, or, you know, doing the private chefing business. It was Christensen's Private Chef, and that was a lot of fun. We got to go into people's homes and cook for them, and yeah, it was
all kinds of parties. And then we finally decided to go and start our own restaurant, and that was probably the worst decision ever. And now we love it, but the first 4 years were really tough.
We opened Soup in August of 2007. August 20th, 2007. Well, we got married in August 26, 2006, and then opened the restaurant almost exactly 1 year later. And it was the really horrible, horrible time to do what we did. And I don't even know how it survived.
Dumb,
it was
dumb luck, I think.
Yeah. That time, Midtown wasn't even a thing. And that area, we wanted to be downtown. And there wasn't anything we could afford or get into downtown as far as rent that had a kitchen space available. And so we were like, well, I guess we could do this, you know, this area over here. It was a, it used to be Luciano's and that had closed. And so we came in there and the Shays owned it at the time. We were at, that was 719 South Virginia Street where we first opened. We had seven tables inside and four little outside tables, but it was super small. They kept getting stolen. Yeah, people would, it was such a different area at that time. You know, we had
crack house next door to us.
Yeah, crack house next door that the cops were always being called to. And then we had Shay's Bar, which is a little shady, you know, gunshots in the back and all kinds of stuff that had happened in that little spot.
Mm-hmm. People passing away upstairs and the coroner's van would be closing our front door, like pulling up in front of it. While people are eating dinner, they're loading bodies out into the van.
Did this happen multiple times?
Once. No, twice.
People, yeah.
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 Wow, up in the apartments.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was some, it was definitely a shady situation there.
The neighborhood at that time, too.
Yeah, it was really, you know, it was a little bit scary down there. And so we were like, gosh, I hope people still want to come eat here. We didn't have a parking problem then, which was kind of funny. But, you know, we started off there and the first couple years were really hard. It was.
And the only reason we did that is we could afford that and there was a restaurant spot available. Mm-hmm. You know, we just couldn't afford anything else. I mean, we really couldn't afford that.
Yeah.
But pulled everything together and, man, that was a lot of work getting that going.
We were, when we first opened, we were only open from like 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. And so we just did lunch, but then.
Just Monday through Friday.
He and I would be there till, you know, 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning prepping all the food. And my mom was our first dishwasher. She came and would stay with us and then. Come over and do dishes and come over and help to make cookies and all of that. Because we opened with maybe three or four employees at the time.
Now we've got 23.
Yeah. Now it's been, you know, we're coming up on 8.5 years and it's been an interesting journey though. But
let's talk a little bit about that space. Like you said, it had been a restaurant before. It had been an Italian restaurant, a pretty well-established Italian restaurant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you actually have to do to the space in order to create the atmosphere that you wanted and to help it function the way that you wanted it to?
I think the history of that little space was fun, too. I think it was a general store way back when, or some kind of little store, and then the Penguin, which was an ice cream. I don't even remember exactly what it was.
Burgers and that kind of yeah. stuff.
An ice cream shop and then a cafe.
And then yeah. another Italian restaurant and then Luciano's. And then when we came in, it needed to be gutted basically. So we.
Yeah, it had a false ceiling. So we
three of them.
Three false ceilings. So we took the false ceilings out to open it up. And then it had windows that were open behind the top windows that were kind of open on top. We had to wall that in order to kind of, because it was all open up there once we took the ceiling out.
Oh, yeah.
And it had this fake painted brick that was really horrible in there.
And it didn't have bathrooms. They'd all been ripped out. So, and the kitchen had been ripped out too. So we had to go in and do all new tile, all new hardwood, new sheetrocking on a lot of spots, build the kitchen, the bathrooms out. The basement was just, oh, scary.
Oh, I didn't know there was a basement.
Yeah.
It's like a half basement. It kind of goes down halfway. Yeah, probably 7 to 8 stairs down. And it was just scary down there. So we sheetrocked down there, painted the floors, put lighting in, cleaned it up, and we did a lot to that building.
What did you use the basement for?
Storage. Mm. Mm-hmm. We couldn't do any preps. There's no hand sinks down there. But yeah, and then we were there for 4 years. And we put way too much money into that spot.
We put all new hardwood floor, like this hand-scraped maple floor into it and really tried to fix it up. It was, I mean, we learned how to tile and everything because we had somebody helping us, but a lot of it was you just got to get it done. So we learned how to tile and to lay all the flooring and to do FRP all of that ourselves. Yeah, putting FRP in and building pony walls and all this stuff that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen the original plans for that building. That's actually a Frederick de Longchamp's design, also that building.
Oh, wow.
And in the plans, there's actually a door from that restaurant space into the apartment that was behind it. Is there any evidence of that that you saw?
I couldn't find it. It was on a different level, too, the apartment behind, because we were looking at taking that back apartment, putting a door in, and using that as more kitchen space. But it was a difference of, I think, 18 inches, so we'd have to go a couple stairs up, and there wasn't enough headroom to clear then. So we run into all kinds of troubles with that.
I don't know how it had been changed at some point, because we had heard back in the day, too, that the people who ran the Penguin lived in the back apartment, in the back house. And at the time we lived there, the chaise, it was all separate. But, you know, we'd have the dip down where it goes into the stairs, and I believe that's where it might have at one point gone up, and they had a different access to the stairs. So it's kind of interesting to... We shared a wall with the chaise, and you could smell the cigarette smoke like wafting through the walls in our ice room and our, uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the food. You know, how did you come up with the concept for what kind of food you wanted to offer at your restaurant?
Well, we lived in Breckenridge, Colorado, and there was a little restaurant there that did mainly just soups and a couple little salads, and no tables, no chairs. You go in, line up, order your soup, then you leave, and I ate there almost every day. I loved it. And so we always thought like it'd be great to do a soup restaurant someday like that. But we figured it would need more out here. Like we'd have to do tables and sandwiches and salads. So we did all that. And, you know, at the beginning, we thought it'd be kind of cute to have your own trays that you come out. It'll be like a fancier cafeteria where you order there. We'll have your French press and your coffee and all this and your sandwich on a tray and bring it out to a nice wooden tray and set on the table. And that didn't even go one day.
We had to make a lot of change. It's funny, something that you envision conceptually, and then when you start to put it into practice, you realize that those things are not going to work. And so we had originally wanted a salad bar, too, and figured that that wouldn't work in that little space because it was so small. So we had to do some changes. And then after the first year of being open, we decided to change to include dinner. So we did a dinner menu, too, and changed that and did a whole different style for dinner. It wasn't sandwiches and salads and soup so much as...
We did linens. We switched the whole restaurant around to, like, a finer dining. You know, you come in, you have a menu. We had flat iron steaks and salmon piccata and all this stuff that we did for about a year. And
corn cakes.
It was a headache, but it was fun. You know, we got to play a little bit. But our menu in the first place, all the soups... We thought it'd be fun because every culture around the world has a soup in a style. So you can pull almost any flavor profile and make something. And most people like soup, I think. And it's cold the majority of the year. I'd say like a good 8 months out of the year, you could enjoy it. And then summer times were just horrible for us the first couple of years.
Yeah.
And now they've raised up and we're pretty even year round. But yeah, and it's fun. We make everything homemade, every salad dressing, every stock, every sauce. And just figure that's the way that we could set ourselves apart. Because you couldn't buy our salad dressing and serve it at another restaurant. That would be our signature step. So everything in our place is our own signature.
How did you begin any advertising or letting people know you were there? Because people weren't accustomed to going to that area for that kind of a restaurant experience. What did you do?
We opened our doors and then we waited.
And I think people had seen, because we were really, one thing has always been kind of our motto is we really love to talk to people. And so we've always been really involved in the community and going to places. And
probably too much so.
Yeah. Like, we go to the bars and hang out and tell these people, hey,
would you come
to a place like that to serve soup? And so it was a lot of self-promotion in that way of talking to a lot of people and getting it out there. And
just word of mouth.
Word of mouth. And then we did advertise with the Reno News and Review when we first opened. I think within that first year we did. But it was amazing that I think Reno was really hungry for something that was a little bit different. And that outside of the casinos downtown and some other, there wasn't a lot going on as far as downtown with restaurants or in that area at all, you know.
You had some of your like mainstays that were amazing, like 4th Street Bistro out there and Lulu's down at the end of Midtown before it was Midtown. I mean, they've been there for quite a while.
Sure.
And Miguel's. And you had those, you know, the good, solid places that have always been there. But our community seems like it's a lot tighter now to where if before, restaurants would kind of battle against each other, and now everybody's kind of playing nicely, you know, and we can call Miguel's, or we could call, you know, whoever, and just be like, hey, can we borrow a cup of sugar? You know, do you have something? Do you need anything? And it's really kind of fun to build that community. I think that's where Midtown has really taken off, is we work together for the most part. You know, there's a couple of people that still hold out and don't like to do that. But the rest of us, it's like, I think that's one thing that started, is we opened there, and then the Hub opened, and Mark and us, like, just loved each other, and we talked, and then Jessica opened Junkie after that, too, and next thing you know, it's just like this little core of people that really...
That I think we realized we needed each other, and mm-hmm. that we wanted to see each other be successful, and we kind of like were out in this ether that was outside of downtown, but we're like, hey, we got to make this work. We're going to figure it out. And so there was a real camaraderie. It was such a... Well, Angela's been there forever and ever.
And tattoos. Ace's Tattoo. Those guys have been there forever. And Kevin's amazing. All those guys are awesome.
But it was a different time where I think people started to realize it was so organic that it happened. And the way it happened was just kind of... We knew we needed each other and we wanted to work together, which was really great. Mm-hmm. And I think we were supporting each other and being there, you know? And it's like sometimes stepping out and opening a business is such a scary thing. And it's something that we don't have all the answers. And a lot of it is just you learn as you go. So if you can do it with other people that are there too, you feel like you have a support system, which is really great.
And there is a sense now of it being classified as a district and being kind of a neighborhood rather than just a corridor with a lot of different things on it. Do you recall when you first heard the word Midtown or when that mm-hmm. started to be established as a thing?
I think it was Jessica that really pushed for that.
Yeah, because people were saying a different name and she's like, no, we'll call it Midtown. We should call it Midtown. Because mm-hmm. I think they were trying to say Soda. Like, are there
Soda.
It was like south of downtown is what they were trying to call it for a little bit, this like Soto area. And we were like, no, that's not us. Like, I don't know. And so Jessica really was the one that I think through the Reno Style Show and through all of her, you know, all of her promotions, she was really big into advertising. And so for us as a restaurant, we didn't do tons of advertising. But I think between the Reno Style Show and then when we started Midtown District and started to put it out there of like, we are going to just brand it, you know, like as best we can and keep getting this into people's names, because then it creates an area for people to come to. And if they've heard of, you know, if they've heard of Junkie, then most likely they're going to be down in that area. They'll probably see Soup too, you know? So it was like, we were all working together to promote the area as opposed to just like promoting our own individual businesses.
You're saying like brand the actual district and not necessarily sell our own, but yeah, just brand the area. And that was the main goal at the beginning, I think, of the district was a brand.
And it's been successful.
Mm-hmm. And have you been involved then in that formal business organization, the Midtown District group?
Mm-hmm.
And how has that group changed over time? I imagine it has expanded, but can you talk a little bit about the evolution of that group, that organization?
Well, sure.
It started small and tight, and then there was a faction that kind of broke off that did the Midtown, no, the Coalition.
Well, that was created, technically, the first Midtown District, the way it started, was like a Midtown Merchants Association, I believe is what it was called. And it started, and there were meetings over at Sushi Pier 2, and only a handful of people were going then, and it was trying to get this momentum. And to be honest, I didn't even go to a lot of those meetings. Christian went to a couple of them. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes when you're so deep down in the trenches of just keeping your business afloat, sometimes you don't have that time to, you know, put into it. And then Living Stones, the two of the guys there started doing the Midtown Night Art Walk, they called it originally, and started getting people to kind of come to the area too. Then when Jessica and Troy kind of took over Midtown District, it really started to gain more momentum. I mean, they really were the catalyst for bringing people together and organizing it and promoting it and getting things done, which was really cool. They were really...
They put a lot of their own money and resources into it, too, on top of just whatever the dues were. But it was just mainly meant to brand. It wasn't there to do events. It wasn't there to do gatherings or art or anything like that. And I think that's where the...
Yeah, when they first started, that was the plan, was just getting the name out there. And then over time, eventually build into these events and all these other things. And I think a lot of people were wanting events and stuff like that and didn't quite understand the branding process and how important it was, or maybe where their money was going. Sometimes I think people want to see something flashy and big and feel like that's where my money went into. And that's where I think Creative Coalition was a different outlet for people that didn't want to necessarily be a part of Midtown District. And so for a while, those two were very separate. Now it's wonderful that they've combined forces, and I feel like are a united front, which is really awesome because, you know, we do have to work together.
There's still quite a few people a handful that were calling it the Midtown Mafia and just very negative, thinking that we're trying to squeeze them out or take them down or take over and just this whole power struggle. And I guess you see that in any structure. It'll happen where you get people that want to do one thing, people that think you're doing it for the wrong reasons, disagree, and there's infighting. But I think that that's been such a small part of it that it hasn't really flourished, and that's been a good thing, because that's kind of, it feels like that's gone away, those negative
definitely
feelings. And now we've gotten through that part, and now it seems like it's just a very healthy organization now. And you know, we're looking forward to the Midtown Heart Walk that the church puts on again this July. They do such an amazing job with that.
Yeah.
The Living Stones,
you participated in that one last year. Were an phenomenal number of people on the street for that
event. And then we do a big free watermelon bar out front of Soup. So
watermelon bar?
I get a couple of cases of watermelon and just start hacking them up out front and carving them and just giving them away, and people don't understand why it's free. But we wanted to make something too that wasn't, you know, the pub crawls and the wine walks are all fun, but they're not as family oriented. So what the church does with that art walk is amazing, where we can each do our own thing, whether it's beer, wine, watermelon, music, art. And it's just, anybody can do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fun with that, so.
So you said that you did some tweaks at the very beginning after opening, and my recollection is that you were always busy. That place was so small, and there were lines, right?
Yeah.
Were
you surprised by that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we thought it would be me in the back and her up front, and maybe we'd hire one or two others.
Yeah.
And we thought we could handle that, you know, just do a handful of people a day and get through it. And the first day, I think we did 60 people. And the second day, it was like 100 and some. And next thing you know, it just went up. And it never let off.
Out the door, like out into the walkway out front. And so then we only had 7 tables. But there were these big 4-seater tables that if there's only 2 people there, we had to make these little signs that said, "I'll share my table." Because we didn't know what to do. If you only have 2 people sitting there, we needed more space. And then we also talked with Shays next door and had brought some of our customers over to Shays, and they would eat their lunch at Shays in this smoky dive bar. But I'm like, I don't know where else to put you, and I've got your food. And so between the share your table thing, which was kind of fun, some people were really not into it, but then other people, it created more of that community too, which I think was so fun. You know, people would say, I met these great people and I got to talk with them and we really enjoyed it. And so, you know, if big cities can do it, little Reno could start to do some of those things too.
Yeah. It was all out of necessity, and next thing you know, it became a fun thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you, Kristen, you're the chef.
Mm-hmm.
Were you back there? Were you the only chef, the only cook, or did you get more help?
I actually, from the get-go, we had my good friend Brian Patterson was with us. And so him and I were kind of like the ones in the kitchen and getting it all done. And then we had to start hiring other cooks too, because there was so much cutting and dicing and slicing. And that's why I'd be there till like 2, 3, even 4 in the morning, and then start again at 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'd come home, crawl into bed for about an hour, if that, and then wake up and then head back down and do it again.
The first day we were open, we counted the drawer out, and it was so difficult. Like, I hadn't really done that whole process for a while, and I'm counting the whole drawer out. And I just looked at him, and we just, like, I remember crying and going, we have to do it again tomorrow.
And the next day.
And the next day, and the next day, what did we do? You know, like, and then people, we would get so busy, and you'd see friends and family come through. And I remember having moments of, like, why are you here? Just go away. Like, because you're so busy, you can't keep up with it. And we were still trying to figure things out, and it was funny. It was,
we did it completely backwards. We opened a restaurant, and then now we finally are learning how to run a restaurant. And luckily, we're busy enough in the meantime to make it float in between. But Yeah, the cooking. I mean, we finally had to... We've gotten some really good systems down in place because of it, out of necessity, to where buying a buffalo chopper to cut our mirepoix for our soups, and different griddles and stuff to do grilled cheese. Now we assemble our grilled cheese with butter, our shredded cheese, the bread, layer them on sheet pans, and we do about 90 in the morning, just layering them all up. And then when people order them, we can take them, put them right on the griddle, cook them up fresh, and send them out within, like, you know, 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's just that we've gotten a lot more efficient. And it's been fun to find out, to figure out the whole how to make yourself better, faster, stronger, and not lose that quality. Like, that's, it's been a fun challenge. I love that.
And you look back and you realize, I don't know how we made it, you know? There was, there was a couple times that we weren't sure because of the economy and everything being so bad too. And then us on a huge learning curve of trying to figure things out. That it was, yeah.
Making what?
Tax mistakes and owing money and having phone calls and...
Had to have garage sales to sell our stuff to make payroll. And those are those things that are interesting, because people see a busy restaurant and they're like, oh, you guys are doing great. And little did they know that we weren't paying ourselves. And, you know, with only 7 tables, you can only get so many people through the door. And it didn't make sense financially anymore. We were struggling so hard and going, I know the concept is solid. I know it can work, but it's just not working here. You know, we had to... It was a real struggle for quite a few years, and then that's what finally prompted us to move.
And when we did that, it made all the sense in the world. We found that balance of the size,
staff
and everything.
Numbers,
and it makes sense.
People.
So and tell
we
me,
we got to pay ourselves.
A bonus,
yeah,
not a bonus, a regular salary.
Exactly.
Tell me about that process then, when you knew you wanted to move, and so how did that go? Where did you look? What were you looking for? Mm-hmm. And how long did it take to find what was right for you?
We started looking at... We were looking for a place that already had a kitchen. We wanted to go back downtown.
Yeah, because we were still feeling like midtown. Well, it wasn't even... I mean, it was kind of midtown, but not really. And we were like, let's just go downtown. And, you know, we had originally looked at a place that was... the old Labuzala is where we were going to go originally, and had... plans drawn up there, and
it's
we're
our bar now.
It's our bar, but yeah, it had been.
But we also looked at underneath that big nightclub. I think it was Rise and 29 North or whatever it was. Remember that big nightclub on the corner of Sierra and Second?
Mm-hmm.
And on the first floor, there was this on the alley side. There was this 20-foot by 100-foot long space that had a kitchen in the very back, left over from the casino when it was there years and years ago.
Oh.
So it had a kitchen in there already. But it was literally 20 feet wide and 100 feet long, this place that we're looking at doing. And so we started looking at that. And then our friend TJ Day and Bernie Carter and those guys, they said, don't leave the area. You know, we've got some plans that we want to do down here, so don't leave the area. And we started looking at the building that we're in now. And they purchased that building, and we were able to work together with them to get it to the point where we could open a restaurant.
So that's 669 South Virginia Street.
It is, yeah.
Yep.
What had it been just previously to being your restaurant?
Kind of like a homeless nest, crack house.
Oh.
And then before that, it was a palm reader.
So it wasn't the restaurant space you were looking for?
No.
Not at all. Not at all. It was absolutely the opposite of what we were looking for.
It was basically a 3-bedroom house with...
a half basement.
A half basement and one big bathroom. So our 2 bathrooms were 1 bathroom before we did the renovations.
And our hot kitchen was the master bedroom.
Yeah, the master bedroom is now our hot kitchen.
And the stairwell to the basement is now
our dish pit.
What's a dish pit?
Our dishwasher, where all the dishes are brought back and dropped off and then cleaned and sent out.
Okay.
So just that whole pit area, the dish pit. And then the little back kitchen where all the tickets come out of is...
That was an addition. Yeah, it was a sunroom, and it's an addition.
So when we started ripping up the floor, it was like slanted and not a real floor. And and the front bedroom and closets and everything like that, we ended up just ripping out. We ripped out all kinds of walls and windows and doors. And next thing you know, her dad and mom, who have been helping us with this process, he does buildings, renovations, all that kind of stuff, he had the idea of building the deck around the whole side of the building in front, and he just would not give up on that. And we're like, we can't afford that, and he just kept pushing. He's like, it's gotta happen. Finally he helped us make it happen, and we're so happy that we did that.
Because how many tables did that add out there?
Oh, 48 more seats. So we got 48 in, 48 out. And it was probably the best decision we could have made with that.
We kept thinking, well, there's just no way. Because here we were coming out of having no money in the old place and trying to... We did so much of the work ourselves on the new place, too.
All the tile, all that.
We did all the tile and laid the hardwood floor again. And, you know, we were like, hey, we know how to do tile. After last time, let's do all the tile. But then we had to... Because we had to lay off all of... Not lay off. We had to tell all of our employees, we're going to be closed for 2 months. And so what do we do? If you want jobs, we'll gladly bring you back in. Or if you want to work in the meantime, you can come and help tile or paint or do all these things. So a lot of them did that. They came over and helped to work to get it done because we knew we were on this tight timeline. We wanted to stay at the old place until we could get the new place ready. But unfortunately, the landlord didn't offer us that option. So we had to get out and go for it. But it was, you know, sometimes you're put in that situation. You just have to make it happen. And so...
I think we opened and we probably had like $10 in our own account.
Yeah, we had...
And nothing in Soup's account. And we opened the doors and same deal. Like, we just sat there. We were waiting. And I think I was coming back from the building department.
No, I was with my dad.
Yeah, with the final CFO. And
we didn't even have money in the cash drawer yet. We were just like, okay, we've got it. I think we're doing it. Because we had told everybody, I think we're going to open today. I'm not sure.
We had one of our old regulars. He still comes in. But
yeah.
He was standing at the counter. And a surly guy. And he's like, when can I order? I want to order my damn food. When can I order? And we're like, we aren't open yet. We can't open, but if you want to wait here. And so when they came through with that, you know, signed paper, then we started cooking. And it's a weird
feeling. We didn't even have a lease signed until that day because it was all done in a handshake with Bernie and TJ.
So Bernie showed up with the lease that day. And he's like, here you go. And so we signed it. And, oh, so stupid.
So aside from the obvious increase in number of seats. So how many seats total then in that new space?
48 inside and 48 out.
Okay.
And we had 28 inside of the old spot.
All right.
Maybe 6 or 8 outside.
So obviously an increase in capacity, which is terrific. Were there other changes that you incorporated going into that new space?
Yeah. We separated our hot kitchen and our cold kitchen. So the old space was just all compacted in one little room. And now we could run our soup line over here and our sandwich line separately so they weren't impacting each other. And so that really helped. We had a walk-in refrigerator. That was huge.
Yeah, the walk-in was huge.
And then I
think... You said it was outside?
It is outside.
Oh, you have to actually go outside to get to the walk-in.
Yeah. I mean, we got to do what we got to do. And that was, you know, I found that on Craigslist down in Sacramento and ran down there and bought it and ended up being two of them all together. So came back with two walk-ins and I think sold one or gave it or whatever we did to Evelyn Mount.
Yeah.
For one of her things, and kept the other one. And
then eventually we switched over to having the street names. We used to take people's name, and then be running around the restaurant asking for, you know, Sharon, where's Sharon? Sharon, is this your food, Sharon? And it got a little crazy with so many people. So we finally switched to street names, and were able to...
Picked, like, all the local street names around us, like Toma and Janie and all that.
You got a great cat here.
Yeah.
She wants to be in on it, too.
That's our ambiance.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, right, so the little more organization there. Yeah. Easier spot.
I think it was just, again, part of that learning process and figuring things out and putting better systems in place to make it more efficient and to...
And then we also opened Creme at the time, so then we could make our cookies there instead of in soup. So we opened Creme with the hopes of just having a little cookie shop. And when we partnered up with Beth Carter... end up doing crepes and a bunch of other stuff out of it. So then I think 2 years ago I sold our half of that and she moved across the street. And
okay.
And then we just refocused on soup.
Okay, so you opened as a partnership with Creme and then you just kind of sold your part of that.
Exactly. I was just I was stretched way too thin. Because we had a breakfast lunch spot and then lunch dinner. And so it'd be some days just like, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning to like 11 o'clock at night. And then a kid and it was just too much. So
how did the idea for Creme come about then? Was that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, something I wanted to, and she said, hell no. And I thought, I was like, I just want a cookie
shop. Because he kept wanting soup to do breakfast, and I was like, we are not doing breakfast.
I
didn't
really want to do breakfast. I wanted to do cookies. Remember, I wanted a cookie shop, and I had a fun, I can't remember the name of it, but I had a fun name, but then I didn't want to do it all by myself. And so there were actually three of us all together that opened Creme.
Who was that?
A good friend of mine, was a good, really good friend of mine, Ralph, Miranda, and then Beth Carter, who is, you know, the Carter brothers, Tim's wife. Mm-hmm. So the three of us decided to get together and, you know, we could each pitch in and get it done. And so we opened that in 2011?
Yes.
Yeah. And my goal was just to do cookies and all different kinds of cookies and fun this and that and do wholesale orders.
Well, and he was supposed to be more of a silent partner in that. We kind of helped him with the concept and helped to get it started and brought some of our knowledge in some of those areas to make it happen. And equipment, yeah.
And then Ralph had to go, so he left. And so it was just Beth and I. And then I ended up taking more of a hands-on role. And she didn't like that either because I was working way too much. So we, that's how that worked out. And it was fun. And it's cool to see it still going and thriving.
Have you always included the little cookie in your meals at Soup?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was a funny mistake.
we started that because it was
our
wedding recipe, like from our wedding cookies. So when we got married, we used that recipe as our treats for all of our guests.
And then put the recipe in there with a couple cookies and a nice little bag. And
so that's our wedding cookie that we serve at Soup.
Mm-hmm. So we started doing it, and then next thing you know, we're doing 600 a day. Oh, yeah. And we love doing it. Yeah, it's fun, but it got a little out of hand. And
they're small, but that adds up.
It does, yeah. Exactly. Like, so I think Rounds is helping us with our cookies nowadays because it's gotten to be so many of them.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, uh-huh. You can do a little outsourcing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and that's one of the big fun things too. Is like between Rounds doing our cookies and they sell our soup sometimes. Mm-hmm. We sell our soup up at Beach Hut Deli. Just started doing signature soups at Picnic for them. And then we serve like House of Bread and Earth Alchemy Sprouts. Well, they're somebody different now. Mm-hmm. But just we all try to help each other. Mm-hmm. That's really fun.
Tell me the story behind the name, because we're saying soup, but it's not spelled the way that you typically think of soup being spelled. So how did you come up with this?
I know, everybody thinks it's like Germanic or Swedish or something. And
it's an umlaut.
Yeah.
It is.
So umlaut P.
We knew our focus was going to be soup, and so we wanted to kind of highlight that and... We were kept coming up with different ideas, and
the counter
was one, and the ladle was another one, and had all these, you know, concepts. And finally, we started looking up soup, S-O-U-P, in Merriam-Webster dictionary, and the phonetic spelling is S-U with the umlaut P. So we're like, oh, perfect!
It just kind of jumped,
and it looks like a happy face too. It's like makes you smile. So
our friend Sarah helped us with the logo, and just love it. And it seems like it hasn't gone as stylish yet.
It's kind of timeless, I hope.
Yeah, just simple.
Did you ever have an issue where people didn't quite know how to pronounce it?
All the time. Like, they say sup.
We'll be working on the deck or like out there and people drive by and scream, sup, as they go by. And I mean, as long as people are talking about it, yeah, that's a good thing.
So you really are just on a block away from your original location.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'd imagine that made it easier to explain to people where you were.
Yeah.
And easy to move, too. We could just roll our refrigerators down the alley.
So talk about how the neighborhood around you has changed since you opened the first location. It hasn't been very long. You said you opened that first one in 2007?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So here we are, almost 9 years later. Mm-hmm. How would you say that the surrounding neighborhood has evolved?
Well, I mean, it's totally different. I mean, there was a good core people there, like recycled furniture, Shays, Ace's Tattoo. There are a couple of those that have been there the whole time. But then everything else is, you just see this infill happening and all these old buildings that get renovated and Maytan getting torn down partially and built back up into this really cool modern building now. And just the life and the, I mean, we keep thinking like it's hit this like max for restaurant, you know, density. But every time a new one opens, we get busier. And I think it just keeps bringing more people that think of the area and that may forget about us, but now they're coming back down to see somebody else and they remember us. And it's neat to see just everybody growing up around there. And it's cleaned up a lot.
And the transformation of all the buildings. Like, you know, right now where it's, I think they call it Midtown Commons, where Wedge and all of those little shops are, Dreamers Coffee Shop. That used to be the Coco Boom nightclub.
And Delmar before
that. And Delmar Station before that. But Coco Boom was, I mean, it was really pretty shady over there. And it was really dark, and it felt, you know, a whole different feeling to the area back then. You know, it's not that there were others that were there before us, for sure, but, you know, there wasn't as much happening as far as new life and new energy and all of this. So it was, you know, it's been awesome to see it transform and to see people invested back in the area and wanting to make it better. And, you know, every...
Like you said, too, back then, where you see a Lexus roll up or a nicer car and you knew that they're coming for food. And now it's like you just see that everywhere. Just like before, it was very rare to see somebody that was dressed well coming into that neighborhood. You know, dressed well, I mean like having all your clothes on, you know? And
dressed.
Exactly, dressed would be it. Because we really would have just craziest things happen. You know, drug dealing is going on our front tables and we had to kick people out. We'd have, you know,
we had a brownie bandit that we at when we were over at 719 South Virginia, we had a guy come in and steal a brownie, and I think at that point we were so one of our customers had told us, hey, that guy just took a brownie.
Well, took something off the counter.
Or took something, And I think at that point you felt like nobody can take anything else. I've worked so hard, like I just baked those brownies, you know? And so Christian heads out down the street running after him and
ended up almost at the pepper mill. And he put, like, right in front of Chapel, well, it's now 40 Mile Club, right in front of there, I finally catch him, you know, and grab his shoulder, and he turns around and tries to cut me with a box cutter. And so I jump back, and everybody spills out of Chapel, and some guy drives by in a truck, he's like, get in! So I jump in the back of the truck, and we follow this guy down, get out, and I start walking, following him again. And I'm on the phone with the police, and I'm about 100 yards behind him, and he keeps looking back and, you know, threatening me and all that. So this truck rolls up next to me, and he's like, is that the guy up there? And these two just burly-looking guys with beards and just scraggly. They go up there, pull over, jump out, grab the guy. He turns and tries to cut them, and they were undercover cops. They put him on the ground. Next thing you know, we're at the courthouse, and they dubbed him the Brownie Bandit.
Yeah.
I think it was a year or two later we got a check for $2.50.
$2.50 for the Brownie Bandit.
But it was a principle of the thing, you know? And
also trying to clean up the area that, you know...
You can't just get away with stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think between us and a few others, like, it slowly squeezed out that bad element.
And I'm saying you can't pee in the alley. You know, you can't pee on that person's building because that would happen. Or
so we keep yelling out the windows at people and next thing you know, like, we come around. It's not all the way gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But
so it hasn't really been attributed to a greater police presence necessarily, but just the fact that there are more active businesses mm-hmm. around... That have had that influence, yeah. You think?
And I think the one thing, too, is I've heard members of the city council, especially the last council, claiming that they helped build Midtown and put it on the map. You know, this council I like a lot. And the other one I did, too. But there are a couple that tried to lay claim to Midtown. Mm-hmm. And the city never did anything for us. Like, it was all organic. It was all us business owners. And then, finally, they came and they you know, we started doing the district. And that's when it was forming. And so...
Well, Hillary Sheevy, Mayor Sheevy,
well, yeah.
She was a part of Midtown District and helped to develop it.
The last council.
Yeah, I think that was the thing is, like I said, it was a really organic thing that happened, and it was through business owners and people that cared about the area and concerned citizens, too, that were a part of the Midtown District that didn't own a business. Maybe they lived there.
Like Barry.
Like Barry, exactly. And so all these people, I think, because we all cared so much and wanted it to be better, it wasn't because the city was... giving us all these things or doing all these things, but it was more, I think, our vested interest. And then all of a sudden people started realizing, hey, this is good for tourism. Oh, this is good for this. And, you know, they started to get behind it too, but it's, you know, it's like you take something ugly and kind of shine it up. And once it starts to get a little shiny, people will start to notice and, you know, want to be a part.
The people like Barry and Paul, like Barry, who drive around in his truck every morning.
Barry who? Is that Barry O'Sullivan?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And so he would drive around in his truck, and if there's graffiti, he'd jump out and paint over it, and, you know, and he'd come give us a hand, like, clean up around the building, and we'd help him out, and he's got buildings behind us, and he's just very invested in the neighborhood, too. Mm-hmm. And it's people like that that really make a difference, I think, in a neighborhood in general. Mm-hmm. It's like him and us and Junkie and everybody. So I think it's just people caring. And
so the district has been defined as extending all the way south. In some cases, they say to Plum Lane, you know, at least Mount Rose into Plum Lane. Does it make sense to you to kind of define that area going down that far south as a district? Does it feel coherent like a district to you or like it might become one?
I think it can become one. And they're the ones on the south end of it feel that they get left out, I think, of certain events. But I don't know. It's just...
I think this is the thing. When it comes down to it, nobody's going to force you to be a part of something that you have to really... want to do that and join it and be a part of it. And I know even Sam for a long time, he's not even that far out, but he would be like, ah, because there was so much happening right at that little St. Lawrence intersection and so many things happening there. And people were all, that was all the buzz, you know? And even Sam Sprague would go, oh man, you know, come on, give us some love down here. Bring people down here. And I think that's where it's definitely extending to that area and to mm-hmm. Mount Rose. I don't know if I feel it because I haven't had much interaction with many of the businesses past that. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think it may take a while for it to spread all the way down to that area. I definitely see it getting closer to that Mount Rose area, though, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Because so many of those businesses are actually involved in it and wanting to be a part of it. And, you know, I think that's the thing that makes the difference is you have to want it and you have to be a part of what's going on rather than just waiting for something to be given to you or do something, you know?
I think that density around our neighborhood has just been greater with locations of restaurants, bars, and retail. And there's little spots down there, but not as cohesive, I think. And so I think it is becoming that. They're filling in all around, and it will happen. And we love them, you know, we all play together too. Like, Sam's awesome. Yeah. Him and I go ride motorcycles together, and then the girls at, you know, Picasso and Wine, like, we go do things there, and it's fun. Mm-hmm. But I think it definitely needs a little bit more, a few more shops opening down there. Kind of like the Lobster Shack that's opening
mm-hmm.
in the old Heritage Building.
Some more
building.
Infill like that. Mm-hmm. All of that is so important. And I think, you know, for those guys that are kind of the Lone Rangers out there farther out, it's been harder for them. So as more people start to come into the area, it'll be better. You know, it's that whole rising tide raises all ships. And
Troy from Lulu is opening the Japanese restaurant there. That's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Just all these new, it's gonna happen. It is happening.
Can we talk a little bit about the foodie culture of Reno and the role that it's playing in the revitalization of the city? It seems like in many ways the restaurants, the eateries have been at the forefront of how people have looked at Reno transforming into this new kind of post-gaming mm-hmm. era, it seems. And your restaurant has received a lot of press nationally, I think, as one of the keys to that early development happening. Is that something that you're aware of or that you think about a little bit? Does that seem to be the case?
I don't really think about it, but every mm-hmm. once in a while we stop and, like, you know, a list will pop up and we're on there like, wow.
Wow, it's,
and
yeah.
It's just very humbling and shocking too. It's like, but I think that you go to other areas, other cities and other popular areas, and the culture, I think, is wrapped around food and drink. Anywhere in the world, really, is like, that's the center, you know, water and food. And so if you start creating that, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's...
No, I hear what you're saying. I think it's so true. You know, it's like having a place where people can come and eat and having a place where people join together. For one, it builds community too, and people want something different outside of casinos or outside of chain restaurants. And there's a whole movement of people wanting to eat healthier and know where their food comes from and non-GMO labeled and organic and locally grown. There's so many of these things that people are more concerned about that I feel like it drives them to be more conscious about the type of food they put into their body.
True.
So all those things are working for us because it's a big nationwide. It's a huge thing right now, all those movements. And so that helps us as a locally owned restaurant and one that sources locally as best we can. And, you know, all those things are helping us out for sure.
Yeah, I guess the foodie culture with that too, where, you know, they've got TV shows around all aspects of it. So it gets people excited and they want to see the real aspect of it and be part of it. They want to be part of the whole movement. And so in our town, I think it's been so based on the past of casinos and buffets and all that, where you'd have certain restaurants outside there, but there was never that restaurant culture where everybody would work together, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now I think that's one of the big differences is that community. And, you know, we can go call Mark Estee or the, you know, guys over at Pie Face or Noble Pie Parlor mm-hmm. and call anybody and ask questions or borrow things or do whatever. And you want to see each other succeed. And then I think if you do that, all the foodie people really want to be part of that too.
That makes me think a little bit about some of these events that have been put on. Can you talk a little bit about Reno Bites?
Oh, yeah.
And your involvement in that?
That one's crazy. Like, that was fun. That started 5 years ago or so. Clint and Natasha.
Mm-hmm.
Clint joined. I think it was five.
Maybe so.
But they just started doing, like, they've been evolving too, obviously. And that's been fun to see, where they want to create a restaurant week. And it goes on in other cities. And so they started small. Their first competition, I think they did with the Chef Showdown, was in the garage, I want to say, over
behind
at Soto.
Behind Soto.
And everybody had to bring their own equipment and food and everything. And we were out of town that year. I couldn't do it. But I heard it was really fun and crazy.
Yeah.
And then the next year, they started at Sizzy's, mm-hmm. I think. Sizzy's Appliances down south. And that was just amazing. I mean, the kitchen's there and the turnout.
So it's a Chef Showdown. It's a competition then.
Yeah. So where they basically have a whole pantry of ingredients. Each chef gets their own kitchen. That's amazing. They did such a great job down there. And then the culinary students, they bring in and give you an apprentice too. Kind of like a helper.
Okay.
So they unveil the ingredient, whatever that secret ingredient is for the year. I think the first year I did it was a tank full of tilapia swimming around. And you had to go catch your own fish, go kill it, flay it, cook it, and all that. And you had 1 hour to create a dish. And that was fun.
And that, you won.
Not that year.
The tilapia you didn't win?
But then the second year I did it was rack of venison.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a huge, like, hacksaw and big old racks. And so we just started hacking things up and ended up taking 2 of the top 3 prizes on that, and I shocked myself as well as other people, I think. Because I'm just a soup guy. You know, they've got the other chefs out there, and I'm just kind of a little soup and sandwich guy. And so then the following year, last year, I ended up, what was the ingredient? It was whole branzino, fish from Turkey. They flew it over. And ended up taking the same 2 top prizes for that this year, and now they all hate me. So I've got a big target on my back, according to them, and next year we're going to do it again, I hope, and hopefully they'll invite me back. And
I'm super proud, though, because I know how talented he is, and so to see, I think he was kind of under the radar, being like this little soup and sandwich guy, but, you know, his skill and the level of cooking he's done has been, you know, like I said, we used to do private chefing and, you know, gourmet meals and all of this, so he's got some great skills, and it was awesome to see him win the top chef.
And the reason we did soup in the restaurant was because we wanted to create something that we could replicate and hopefully do multiple soups in the future, and something that we could do and then train and have people run it without us having to be there every shift, so we could still have a good balance of life, because that's the hardest thing with a restaurant, I think, is to...
And we're closed a lot of holidays and things like that. You know, those things were important to us just because we've always been in the restaurant industry, and you work every Christmas and you work every Thanksgiving and you work because that's how it is. And so we were like, no, we're going
to
close. The first year we were open, we closed like every bank holiday. I think I could tell you how overdone I was. But, you know, like we closed for a lot of those holidays because it's important to our staff. And so I give them an option. I said, do you guys want to be open on Black Friday this year? You know, and they're like, no, we don't want to. So like, okay, great. We'll be closed. Because for us, I realized the importance of family and being able to be in a restaurant industry and still have a family life and not, you know, not be slave to it.
And that's where these little competitions and events are so much fun, because we get to play, you know, play more. Just like, I like that.
So you talked about the possibility of having additional locations. Is that something that's on your near horizon right now?
We tried to last year and we failed at that, but you know, the best thing is just get back up and keep going. And so right now we're just going to keep making our place stronger and better, and don't really have a timeline for a second one, but our next goal is to open our salad dressing line. And so we're going to be bottling our salad dressings.
Oh.
And so we figure we're going to do that, and then after that, possibly look into another location.
So what is involved in creating and having bottled and marketing your own salad dressing? Is that a big learning curve to figure that out?
We found out it is now, yeah. Like, we thought it would be a lot easier, and we actually have some friends that do it, and they've been doing it almost since we opened.
They do sauces and marinades and things like that, and so they've been awesome. Yeah, Mr. G's, like, Hawaiian teriyaki sauce and all of that. They've been so awesome to sit down and mentor with us and kind of give us some hints and tips and, you know,
all the insight.
Yeah.
Because it is a lot more than just kind of making salad dressing, putting a bottle and selling it. You know, you got to create the relationships with the stores, and you have to go in, you have to stock your own shelves, and you have to clean the bottles and make sure it's all good. And
stick your stickers on, unless you get a sticker machine. You know, all these things that are...
It's got to be 2 inches or 2 fingers from the top of the cap to the top of the shelf, and it's all this stuff that you never thought about. And then all the labeling that goes into it, where the FDA requires you to do certain fonts and sizes and colors on your label. And so it's all the stuff that we had no idea, and barcodes.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely a learning curve, and we'll get it done this year. Mm-hmm. And so we'll start with one dressing, or white balsamic vinaigrette first, and we'll go from there.
And will you be able to do that in your current facilities, or do you need to have a new location just to, for that operation?
We may start in our current facilities, and then if it takes off, we'll open another shop. But I figured the more that we can do that, it's like even more local stuff. You know, we can offer our own salad dressing and sell it out of our store, the Co-op, Whole Foods, Raley's, and just get more. I love seeing local labels out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Mr. G's and Frankovich Eggnog and Great Basin Icky and all that. Like you go into a store and you start seeing all those, and it makes you more proud of the area and the people that we have here. We got so much talent in this city. I think that's the big thing of our city now, is we've got so much pride, but we also don't want many more people coming in. So we embrace the seedy vision that people have of us too. You know, it's almost like keep us weird, keep us dirty, keep us
quirky.
You know.
So what, how would you define what success would be to you, to feel like you had achieved what you would like to, what you have always had in mind?
To pay bills and
I feel like we're there, you know. Yeah. It's like everything else, we'll always strive to do more and do better and to learn new things, but you know, for us, it's, I really feel like that contentment and being happy with, I've done something that I'm super proud of, and that we are happy and have a family that we get to enjoy, and you know, have our son and all of those things. Those are the and great friendships and family. You know, those things are community for sure.
Yeah, I think it's just, I don't know, we did something, we built it from the ground up, and we're proud of it, and it works so far. You know, they could quit coming in tomorrow, obviously, but so far it works, and I'm very proud.
And we
of
don't
it.
Have to be there every day working every shift the way we were in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I remember being sick, and they would try to send me home, my other coworkers and staff, and they'd say, you got to go home, you're sick. I'm like, no, I can't, because you felt so, you know, you had to be there for every little thing and do every little thing. And so now having our staff is absolutely amazing, and we wouldn't be anywhere without them. They are my hands and feet and brain, and you know, they do all that thing that, all the little things that I can't do, every little thing, you know. And so I had to learn how to delegate and give them things to do and trust them to do it and empower them to do it. And that's been huge, you know. And
the restaurant's been kind of like a baby.
Yeah, it was our first baby.
In multiple ways, where it's like we've had to grow up and learn how to walk, or crawl and walk and then run. And now it's, you know, kind of self-sufficient, where you can let it play in the other room and not have to worry about it as much, you know. Still falls down every once in a while, and still scrapes its knees, and you gotta take care of it.
You gotta check in on the monitor and make sure it's not doing anything crazy, and then. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's like it can play well by itself, and it can handle that and take care of itself.
You're proud of it and watch it, you know, grow. It's really fun.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Oh, yay! Thank you.